Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners come to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth. With your hosts, financial and wealth building experts, Christian Allen and Rod Zabriskie.
Welcome into today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Allen, and with me, as always, Rod the Pod Zabriskie. What's up, Rod?
Hey, I am doing great. How are you?
It couldn't be better. I was like grumpy 10 minutes ago, but I'm happy now. I'm excited, Rod. I like when the sun's shining. The sun's shining. It's cold as garbage, so I don't like that. but other than that, I'm good, man. Like, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to have this conversation. There's some kind of big news that we've got coming down the pike here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Our big news is, man, I just can't tell you how happy I am about this. We finished writing the book. So we've been writing this book for the Invest with Benefits book that we started. How long ago did we start this book? A year ago, it feels like?
Probably about a year. Yeah.
Ugh, painful. Anyway, I'm really excited to say that we turned in at least very close to final manuscript of the book. So the good news is we are going to be releasing a book called Invest with Benefits very soon. So keep your eyes open for that. We don't have the exact date yet, but we will be picking like a target date for the release and launch pretty soon. So that's like the big news that I have. And can I just tell you, the load that I feel off my shoulders is immense. So like from that standpoint, like, yeah, I really am doing pretty well.
Yeah. And you put a lot of work into it. So
it's nice. Well, writing isn't like my thing, you know, mm-hmm. Like I'm not one of those people that just picks up a pen. Well, no, nobody does that anyway, starts typing and just loves to type, just loves to go. Like, I get that there's people who are passionate and really good at that. I'm not like terrible. I'm not bad at it, but I don't love it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So for me, it ends up being more work, but I also at the same time really wanted to get out the principles that we talk about in a format that people can easily digest and take action when they hear it. So for that reason, even though it was painful, I feel like it was worth it. I feel like it was
absolutely
worth it. Okay. But the reason I mentioned that is because today we're going to be talking about the wealth multiplier framework. And basically the idea is we want to talk about how Rod and I actually apply the six core principles within the Invest with Benefits philosophy. And let me just remind you, those are leverage, velocity, cash flow, tax optimization, asset protection, and estate maximization. Yes, I've been through these many, many, many times. Yep. So that's what we're talking about. But I thought, let's take a personal approach to this and just talk about like how we utilize these actual principles. Because it's one thing to say, okay, hey, these principles help people build wealth, but it's another to actually understand the how or the connection between the principle and the action. So today—
And why we're so passionate about it, right? They became core principles because it's not just because we, whatever, went out and did research and you know, there's obviously some of that thing. But more importantly, it's what we've done ourselves and what we've seen a whole host of other people do in their own lives in building true wealth.
Yeah, well said. We live it and we teach it and we've seen the proof. And so like we're passionate about sharing it with people. Okay. So the wealth multiplier framework, Rod, I'm excited to dig into this because I feel like every time we have these kind of conversations, I get a little nugget that I didn't know about you and how you're doing things. So I think this will be interesting, but let's start with my favorite principle. The one that I say is the most critical, the most powerful wealth building principle that exists, and that is leverage. So I think everybody knows what leverage is. We're not even going to get into leverage. We'll get into some of them. We'll talk through like velocity, what that means in a little bit more detail. But everybody knows leverage is utilizing debt to build wealth. And we talk about it in other contexts, like, you know, leveraging your time, leveraging resources. But we're specifically talking here about leveraging money, right? Like a bank, someone else's money to help us build our wealth. Okay, so my question to you, Rod, is if when you take a step back and you look at your own world, what are some of the ways that you see yourself utilizing leverage to continue to build your personal wealth?
If I'm going to start personal, I'm going to start from where I began, and that is culturally, I was taught to avoid debt.
Ah, yes. Okay? That's a good point.
So this one took a bit of a journey to go from a place. And when I say culturally, I mean just my upbringing, very conservative. Family state, you know, community all environment that I live in. And conservative in that sense also meant avoid things that are perceived as risky. And so debt was one of those, right? Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I'll say is, I wasn't ever a Dave Ramsey, like, you know, disciple or anything like that. But I would listen to him, you know, when I was young and kind of bought into this initially, again, this idea. And it was, I really had to learn this one. Learn in the sense of logically making sense and getting to a place where I could overcome those initial thought patterns and whatnot to get to a place. And I think this is the thing that did it for me, okay? So paying off your home.
Right. Oh, yep.
That's okay. Paying off your home is a big one, because that's usually the largest debt that people have. Get out from under it. You talked earlier about the burden that you feel lifted off your shoulders by finishing the book. And people use similar language when they talk about, I paid off my home. The burden feels lifted.
Yep, people feel that. It's like there's places. Okay. I'm thinking about like older communities. I've heard people talk about how they like get together and it's like people like get like, applauded for their paying off their house, you know?
Yes.
So it's like, yeah. Like it, to your point, a lot of people are really making a big deal as that is like a really critical milestone to being financially independent, right?
Yep. And again, it's not that I have completely turned my face away from that, but the kind of critical moment that I had was if you're focused on building wealth and basically being in a position where you could pay off your home anytime you wanted to, then me carrying the debt, the mortgage on my home at 3%, it doesn't feel like the same kind of burden, right? It's only a burden if I get into a pickle, can't make my mortgage, get kicked out of my home and lose whatever equity I built up. But ironically, if I'm putting all of my resources to paying down the home and not doing any of those other things in terms of building wealth and emergency funds and all those other things, then I get in that same pickle. I don't have a backup plan. I don't have backup money to help me out. I'm going to lose the home quicker, and I'm going to lose all that extra debt, all that extra equity that I worked so hard to build up by making extra payments toward my mortgage.
It's bizarre, Rod, because what you're describing is a situation where by doing the very thing that we're talking about, the conservative groups are saying, mm-hmm, hey, this mm-hmm. is the way to keep yourself safe. By doing that very thing, you're actually finding yourself in a lot riskier position.
Right.
And that's a really, like that really does take a paradigm shift. And I think it has to do with the idea that, or the difference between being able to pay off or being like having plenty of liquid capital in place. Because if I have that, then I'm fine. But if I don't, and so what's happening there is like people have to take a step back and look at the why behind it, right, rather than just it is what it is, right? And I think as we grow up, again, both of us grew up in the same culture here in Utah, we kind of just grew up assuming like, okay, this is just how it is, right? And mm-hmm. so you do, we've had to like retrain the way that we think about money. But I think the thing that did it is, at least for me, was just taking a step back and trying to understand why I was doing it instead of just doing it because someone said so. Mm-hmm. I wanted to think it through. And it feels like that's kind of what you're describing.
Right. And being able to see people, because early in my career, when I was, you know, sitting down at the kitchen table with people and looking at their finances here locally, again, same environment, how many people I saw that's really where they were directing all of their money. This isn't just, oh, but why would someone pay down the mortgage if they haven't built up their emergency fund or whatever? And I think I was asking myself the same questions. Like, it seems out of order. And I get that there are people out there who are preaching something different than what people were doing. But what happened is people got so indoctrinated with that idea that debt is bad, get rid of it as quickly as you can, that then they kind of took it to the extreme and were putting themselves in more risk, like you said, than they would have been otherwise.
We stopped thinking about it ourselves.
Right.
right? Yep. It just becomes what is rather than something that I'm doing with a purpose. And so again, if you take a step back, anybody that takes a step back and we were to describe, here are the reasons why, there is nobody that's thinking logical who would not say, oh yeah, that does make sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like we described this tragic situation of somebody not having enough liquid money, ending up losing a job, becoming disabled, something happening. Mm-hmm. And suddenly not only can they, like they can't get to the equity in their house and they can't pay their mortgage.
Yep.
And they don't have the liquidity. And now all of a sudden you've blown it up.
Yep.
Nothing you can do about it. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. So I know this isn't, that wasn't the reason you asked the question, but that became a starting point for me to start to think differently about debt. And then the next step was, well, not only is there not only bad debt, but are there good uses for it? Are there good ways we can use leverage to build, being wise, you know, making sure that we are thinking clearly and not just rolling with whatever people say. And so that becomes a place where yes, there is debt that can be used to build wealth. And again, we have to be smart about it. We can't just let it, you know, get carried away and let it carry us away, because it can, but when used appropriately, it's huge.
Okay. I have a question for you, Rod. Are you ever going to tell us how you use leverage?
Yes.
That was the original question. I'm just saying.
Yes. Okay. So now I'm on that part. So good debt. Yes. In the sense of, well, investment optimizer, right, is a way to use debt, and it's always fully backed by an asset that's sitting there acting as collateral, right? So
yeah, that's like the safest way to use debt, because like there's no way to get in trouble. But I do want to clarify, because you're saying using it as, it is literally using debt.
Yep.
Again, people oftentimes don't realize it because they think, well, we have this cash value that builds up. But again, just as a reminder, the cash value is the collateral. It is not the money that we're using. And so we're very literally using the insurance company's money when we decide to pull a loan and go invest it. And again, that's a critically important part, because that's what makes it leverage, right? If we were just pulling our cash value and putting it back and forth, then there would be no leverage element.
Yeah.
So anyway, this is one. Obviously, we use this a ton. Like this is kind of the this sits at kind of the core of both of what we do. So that makes sense.
That was an easy starting point. But the other one I want to use is just in business, right? Mm-hmm. So debt, loans, having a line of credit, et cetera, is really important in a business setting, because often that becomes the liquidity, so to speak, that you use to expand when opportunities come around and you can build your business that way. So that's probably the second most critical thing that comes to mind for me in terms of how I've used leverage.
Okay, so the way I view leverage is this. I want to use leverage for any situation that I possibly can. Now, again, good leverage, conservative leverage, right? We're not talking about credit card debt. I'm talking about for the purpose of building wealth. I guess what I'm saying is, if I have an investment opportunity and there's any situation where I have a reasonable and good way to get a loan to fund it versus me taking my cash and funding it, I will always choose to take the debt first, right? Now, again, with the maybe obvious caveat that if it's, they're giving you a loan at 20%, like obviously I'm not talking about that.
Sure,
if I'm
getting
good quality debt, like I would always tend to go over that direction. So that's like, when I think about leverage, that's the way I think of it. And same thing, when you talk about my personal residence, I'm not paying off my personal residence unless I was paying a crazy high interest rate. Mm-hmm. I can use that money more effectively to build wealth in other ways, whether that's through a physical investment, whether that's money that I can put into marketing in the business. Like there's a hundred ways that I can think of to use that money more effectively that creates, we're going to talk about this, creates velocity. And so like, it just makes sense to kind of keep the leverage going and keep the money in motion, because anytime that I compare and contrast, I find that the math works better by utilizing leverage.
Yeah.
And so that's it. Like my philosophy is just use it whenever you can to make sense of it. Again, I can't say it enough. Conservative leverage, good leverage. We're not talking credit card debt. We're talking about the kind of leverage that we get when we're buying a real estate property, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. I'm glad you brought in the key phrase, conservative leverage. That's the key.
That's the key. Yep. We've coined it. And we always say it because I think part of it really is like our background, mm-hmm. right? We did grow up in a conservative world, and we don't want people to think like, hey, we're just like spending willy-nilly. We're taking massive risks. We're getting highly leveraged. We want to make sure that we're suggesting that it's like responsible leverage.
Yes.
Okay. That's leverage. Like, obviously, we're both using leverage a lot. Let's go to velocity, Rod. And I want to just quickly, because this one isn't as self-explanatory. So mm-hmm. do us a favor and talk about what you view velocity as, and then we'll talk about the ways that we're actually using it in our own life and business.
Yeah. So velocity, the part that really helps me understand it is when I look at it from the kind of macroeconomic view,
yeah.
and the way that they use velocity. I think that's where the term originally came from as we learned it. And all that means is when you look at GDP, right, the total amount of business that gets done in a country or a state or whatever. Well, what's interesting about that is when someone goes to work and they walk home with a paycheck, that's part of the GDP. They got paid, right? Then the next day they go to the grocery store and they buy groceries. That adds to the GDP. It was the same money. The same money that they received is what they're turning around and using, but it actually counts twice. And then the grocer goes and buys, you know, money from the wholesaler. The wholesaler buys ingredients, et cetera, right? So the pattern keeps going. And what from an economic standpoint, what they measure is the speed at which that money moves from hand to hand to hand is a huge benefit to the community as a whole. The GDP goes higher as a result. Everybody is benefiting from all of those different transactions. And the faster that goes, the better it is for everybody. Okay.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I like the framework on that.
Now what we're doing is we're taking that same principle and now putting it into your personal wealth building journey. And saying
your personal wealth building economy, Rod.
There
right?
you go. Steve.
You're using the exact same principles of the economic. It's your economy, and you're keeping money in motion.
Yes. So, and again, I'm not going to use the investment optimizer for all of these principles, but one just feels like it's a natural fit because I put the money into the policy, but it doesn't stay there. I then take a loan against it to go and invest in something. And now it's working for me in both places. And in most cases, I'm investing in something that creates some sort of cash flow coming back to me. I take that cash flow, I capture it back into the policy. Again, not because it's going to stay there, but because I'm going to take another loan as soon as I build it up to a reasonable amount, again, go out and invest in something else. As time goes on, I have a bunch of different flows moving in and out of that policy. And that's really where I can see the velocity taking place, right?
Yeah. And you're quite literally accelerating the growth of your personal economy in that situation by making sure that the money that you invest, or that you're getting the money you invest back and reinvesting. Because obviously, if money sits around dormant, like it's not going to do it. And not only that, but like when I think of velocity, I also think about just multi-purpose. That's probably what I want to think of.
Yeah.
Like a similar way to think about it is that we're letting our dollars, letting our money, dang it, I did a rod. I said letting our dollars.
Aha,
you always like say it. You're running off on me. Anyway, you're letting your money or your dollars work for you in multiple ways. So the example of using the investment optimizer does make sense because now we're suggesting leverage. And obviously, mm-hmm. the investment optimizer strategies is literally at the core of the way we invest. So it will fit every single one of these. In fact, I think we did a podcast back, you know, months ago, maybe a year or so ago, where we talked about how the investment optimizer actually checks all of these boxes.
Yes.
So the good news is that you, Rod, have an easy answer to all of these questions. You can say investment optimizer on everyone confidently. But I like it because we're building on it, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it is important to emphasize like the how on how that's happening. It's one thing to say, okay, I created this opportunity fund, right? I've started to, mm-hmm. I want to implement the investment optimizer strategy. I know I'm creating some leverage with it. How does the velocity actually work? Help us understand. So I think that's a good one. And I think the way that you put it is perfect. I would just say for me, it really is like I get itchy if my money's not doing stuff. Now, mm-hmm. I've let this caveat be out a lot. Right now I have higher capital sitting in dormant places than I like because I'm using it actively on building the house.
Yeah.
But it still pains me, Rod. I can't,
right.
I feel it, right? So it's one of those things where I just know if I can keep the money in motion, I can keep it doing something. If I don't have 3 months here and 3 months there where money's just sitting there stagnant, that's going to make a huge, huge difference, especially when I combine it with these other principles that we're talking about. Okay.
Yeah. So that's and can I just throw one more, like, I don't know, warning out there? Because to your point,
warning.
Yeah. Yeah. We often run into people who feel that same way of what you just described. And that makes it so that they don't keep enough liquidity.
That's true.
So there is danger in thinking, well, I have to have all of my money, all of my dollars, always working for me all the time. But we also have to be careful about that.
Okay. So the good news is though, if you're using the investment optimizer strategy, that can help because at least if my money's there, it's still earning a relatively decent return. It's still beating inflation, right? I'm still getting a tax-free benefit. So it's like one of the, like the enormous benefits of the strategy is just that I can feel more at ease if and when I do need to leave my money. The trick though, is that I've got to figure out how to get as much of my money flowing through that as possible. Yep. And, you know, because of the way that life insurance is funded, that can be a little bit tricky. It's not as simple as just saying, I've got a few $1 million, I'm just going to stick it there and now start moving it in and out. I've got to come up with a funding strat. Okay. Well, I don't want to get into the weeds on that too much. Let's talk about cash flow, Rod. Cash flow. I feel like cash flow is your favorite topic. So why don't you talk about why you love cash flow so much? And again, some of the, like, something you're doing in your world to create cash flow. And I have a couple of examples that I can throw out there as well.
Okay. Well, this probably goes back to maybe the first catalyst that put me on this journey, going back to the Rich Dad, Poor Dad book, because the kind of light that clicked for me was when he talked about creating enough cash flow, passive cash flow. He always calls it passive income, even though, as we know, it's not necessarily passive, but the differentiator he's trying to make is you don't have to go to work every day to make it happen. Right.
Yeah.
So creating enough passive cash flow to replace the working income that puts you to true financial freedom, as opposed to, we always contrast this against the traditional accumulation method of retirement, where you feel like you have to build up enough money sitting somewhere, again, invested, growing, hopefully. But you're basically just going to live off of spend down that asset. And that's what makes it possible for you to retire. I felt much better about this whole cash flow mind frame because it just feels like it's more secure, a better way to go.
More efficient. It's more practical. Like there's so many, it's less risky, right? Yep. All of these reasons. Like if I can go to the cash flow model and I know that instead of having $3 million in a 401k or IRAs, I've got $30,000 a month of cash flow, like that is just tremendously better. Right. Yep. And of course, I always talk about the fact that there's if you have that going on, you also have an underlying asset that's growing. So the challenge with like using the market as that catalyst is the market sometimes has to like struggle between whether it's gaining value or losing value and simultaneously creating the income for you. Well, it can't necessarily do both very effectively. But when you talk about like a real estate syndication, the underlying value can make its movement. It's going to have movement in it, but it's not necessarily going to impact the cash flow that comes out of it. And that's from my perspective, one of the key differentiators.
Yeah, totally agree. So then you might say, well, what do you do with the cash flow now? Right? Because I am still working.
Yeah.
And will be for the,
do you have investments that you like, I only have like a couple that I've actually actively invested for cash flow. So I guess what I'm asking, Rod, is do you have investments right now that you are investing specifically for cash flow?
I would say that isn't my primary goal. And that's kind of where I was headed with this because I don't necessarily need it now. To the extent that I am creating cash flow, I am just flowing that back into my investment optimizer because that builds it up and I'll go out and invest that somewhere else. So that's the model right now. As I get closer to that point, then I will be more picky about what I invest in, specifically for cash flow.
Yeah, you'll transition. And that's the way I view it. At this stage of the game, we have a high income that comes from our business. So investing for cash flow can just sometimes increase our taxes, right? So from that standpoint, it's not necessarily the best idea for us at this moment, but it is a really great idea to be putting those building blocks in place so that I can make a natural transition to a cash flow model as I get later in life, right? And that's kind of the way I view it. Now, if you're somebody that is like, you could be 40 years old and be like, hey, I want to just go do my thing in 5 years or immediately, then it makes sense to start investing for cash flow right there and then, right?
Yep.
But if you're somebody who just doesn't have the intention of doing it at this moment, then I think the goal is a little bit different. We still want to have an eye on cash flow. We still want to be thinking about what that's going to look like. We definitely don't want to use the 4% rule. We want to focus on a cash flow model over the accumulation model. But it might look a little bit different. It might be more like, again, a plan that's targeting creating, you know, cash flow at the age of XYZ. Yep. But again, good news is you can do that in a lot of ways. There are a lot of investments out there that you can choose to take cash flow at different times. So there's actually some flexibility depending. And of course, you can also, you'll want to be looking at different time frames. So like, let's say that I have a real estate syndication and maybe I have them, laddered. That's the word I was looking for, right? I could do some sort of a laddering strategy. There's also stuff that I could just say, hey, I'm not going to take cash flow from a real estate deal. I'm just going to, you know, focus on putting it back in, and then I can turn it into cash flow at a future point in time. But at the end of the day, like, cash flow is infinitely better than the accumulation model. And it's remarkable to me, Rod, that this still gets taught. This is why we say traditional financial planning is broken. Like, I think for more than any other reason, it's the difference between the accumulation and the cash flow retirement model. Man, it just makes me crazy. So, but I don't invest for cash flow. I have a couple of them. So I think I mentioned this maybe in a recent pod, but I invested just recently in a CPA firm, and that one is supposed to be a cash flow. Like, I say cash flow, like, it's basically returning capital over the next couple of years, and then it turns into cash flow at that point.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's one that has high potential, high opportunity. And so for on both the cash flow and on the growth side of it. So for that reason, I felt like it made sense. But typically at this stage of the game, like, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to go from, you know, a 7-figure existing income to one that's a couple $100,000 higher because I'm trying to create cash flow out of an investment.
Yeah. Yeah. So think of it like velocity in that sense, right? Because like you said, getting that return of capital is important. So then you can go make it work for you somewhere else, but it's still working for you in that at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, this is good. So we've talked through leverage, velocity, and cash flow. We got to get into everybody's favorite topic, taxes. And I feel like I'm a broken record because taxes are just such a big expense. I can't help but to remind people that taxes are without question the largest expense that every high income earner will ever pay. Yeah. Therefore, if I can come up with ways to reduce taxes, I just should. So that I think about it. And now that, again, caveats here, we don't want to go crazy. We're not talking about going, we're talking about staying in the white. We're not even I don't even believe in necessarily like running into the gray when it comes to taxes, because I don't really want to end up, you know, in an auditor, you know, that just feels like a big pain. Yeah. But the difference between being able to save 5 or 10% in my taxes, even, or potentially a lot more if I'm good at planning, is a big enough deal that I just have to make it a priority. So in my situation, and we obviously do this stuff together, we have been chasing quality tax optimization for years, right? And trying to find the right places. Like, the good news is we found some people that are credible, that we've learned a lot from. And yet I also just have to acknowledge that finding good, a good advisor, a good tax advisor who can help you do this whole tax optimization thing is a it's tricky business. It's not easy. Like, it's going to take some work. But I guess what I'm saying is, I believe for us, it is worth it, and it's going to continue to be worth it. And I believe for anyone listening to this pod, it's absolutely worth it, even if it's a pain. So if you're one of those people who's like, okay, I've got a CPA, or maybe I've looked around and, you know, I've had a hard time finding the right person, like, keep doing it, right? Keep looking, find the right person, because they are out there. And when you find the right person, it'll put you in a tremendously better position.
One thing that we've learned is we were always trying to make the tax strategist also be the tax preparer, right? And bookkeeper and all the different things that we wanted from them. And the conclusion we've come to is those that are really good on the tax strategy side get so busy that if they're trying to do all of it, they fill up really fast and they just can't keep taking on new clients.
Yep.
However, there are some out there who focus on tax strategy, and they don't care who files your taxes. They're not wanting, right? They're so busy. Yeah, they don't want to add and file the taxes for you. So what you can potentially do is, if you have someone that you have worked with, they're reliable, they're timely, you have a good relationship with them, you don't necessarily have to leave your tax preparer. Go find a tax strategist, let them do that work for you, help you be proactive on that side, but you're still coming back and actually filing the taxes with the same person you have been.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Okay, so Rod, I try to do a lot of things from a tax optimization standpoint. They don't always work as well as I want them to, but we try. And that's part of why, you know, we're always kind of looking for opportunities. Like recently we did that. We had the webinar with David Perez where we talked about some kind of proactive planning methodologies where you can invest money, use leverage, and get massive tax deductions. So those kind of situations can be really a really winning situation. And so now for a lot of the listeners here, like that deal ended up filling up really fast, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of us didn't even get into it. We wanted to get into it and didn't get into it. But those are the types of things that we need to be looking for, because when we do get them, they just make a massive, massive impact. Now, again, with my caveats, that doesn't mean that we're not careful. We don't do the due diligence. We don't study. We don't make sure that we're comfortable with it. Those things have to be in place. But if we do, if those things are in place, then it's worth it. And again, if we're not actually it's kind of the word proactive, right? If we're not proactive, then nothing's going to happen here. Like we're not, the taxes are just going to eat at us and we're going to be complaining under our breath for the rest of our life. But the reality is if I do the correct planning, then I can make a big dent in this tax thing. So anyway, for me, it's not a done thing. It's like a journey. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Tax optimization is an ongoing journey. It's not a one time you do it and then you're good. It's an every year constant thing that I'm looking at and considering, looking for opportunities that fit into that proactive tax planning world, because again, they make a huge difference.
Yeah. And there've been a few people I've talked to who felt like they arrived, so to speak, like they figured out the formula that they were perfectly happy with. I'm not one of those. I'm still on a quest to continue to improve the tax optimization. And you could say that's because I'm still paying more taxes than I would like to. That is a true statement. But it's also true to say that there are investment opportunities especially in the alternative space. That's one of the reasons why we like the alternative space so much, where you can create those. You are investing, you're creating that value, you're building wealth, and you're doing it in ways that you can have that tax, like save on your save. And that's an important word, because we don't want to just defer taxes. We want to, wherever we can, we want to save taxes.
Yeah. And there is a massive difference between those two things. Okay. Asset protection. This one's obvious. I'll talk about a couple things I do. So one thing I do that I just recommend, when we've been recommending this for years, and that is a big umbrella policy.
Yeah.
So it's so inexpensive that in my mind, it's just a non-negotiable to me. Like, I feel like I have a huge extra layer of security in case of, you know, creditor type situations, lawsuits, anything like that. And it's costing me very little to do it. Like, a few hundred dollars a year gets me, you know, $3 or $4 million of additional protection. So in my mind, that's just one way, but it's one of many ways. I, Rod, am proud of this because I've done a lot of stuff in this world over the last while. And some of that fits in the estate planning and asset protection oftentimes fit into the same place, or like, because, you know, you work with your estate planning attorney who oftentimes are asset protection attorneys. They're not necessarily, but they're oftentimes in a kind of similar space. And so when I went through and I did all the estate planning, we also simultaneously tried to focus on making sure that we were doing this asset protection piece, which in my case meant, you know, the right kind of structures for the investments, for our business, you know, where to place the house, all of those types of things that create an additional layer so that if tragedy strikes, there's a protection there. Yeah. So what are some of the things you're doing? I mean, I'm sure you're doing a lot of the same things I am, but
yeah, I'm going to back you up on the umbrella policy. And maybe I'll explain it really quickly just in case there are people who aren't as familiar with that. So we all pay for homeowners insurance, which carries with it some level of liability, kind of slip and fall stuff. If someone, you know, whatever, gets hurt on my property, then I have some liability coverage there. I have my car insurance that covers all kinds of different things as it relates to that. But those have limits. The umbrella policy increases the limits universally across the board. So when Christian talked about having an additional 3 to 4 million of an umbrella policy, on his car policy still carries the whatever $750,000 maximum coverage for personal injury or, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But if he's involved in something that is his fault and they're coming back on his insurance, and then all of a sudden the personal injury exceeds whatever his limit is, that umbrella policy comes in and automatically covers that up to that 3 or 4 million. So it does a couple of things for you. Number one, it the money is there to pay for it, right? That's one thing. The other thing that I think about that may be even more important than that is it's almost like a guard against getting sued. Meaning if it's me gathering my own attorneys and having to defend myself, that's not nearly the same as if it's the insurance company and their attorneys that are basically defending me, right? They're in front of me because they're the ones that are on the hook that have to pay it if the judgment comes down on it. And so they're putting all their resources towards defending the position. And I think that is a huge benefit. And even that alone could be enough to say, hey, go get you some umbrella coverage. So anyway, that maybe that's more than I needed to say, but hopefully that gives people an idea for what, like, the benefit, the value that brings.
I think it's good. And it's just one of those things that is kind of a no-brainer. Like, if you're a high income earner, it's worth it to have an umbrella policy. Because guess what? A lot of people, here's the thing. A lot of people don't realize that sometimes I think, like, as a culture, we're really judgmental about people who have money troubles, right? And yet, oftentimes those money troubles stem from things like an illness or things like a lawsuit or there's so many ways that can happen. And so my point here is just to say, like, if I don't have that umbrella policy, if I haven't done that asset protection, I'm putting myself in tremendous risk to be in that situation, even as a high incomer, right? I could easily find myself in a very difficult financial position, even as somebody that has a lot of money and makes a lot of money.
Yeah.
And why not avoid that, right?
Yep.
So anyway, asset protection is critical. Make sure that's a huge priority. Okay.
Yeah. Can I hit on one other thing on that?
Nope. We're done with asset protection. Go for it.
Okay. So, and this one I'm going to go pretty quick on because a lot of people, again, that we know we want to hold assets in an LLC or something that creates some separation between liability that we carry in, say, if we own a rental property or something. We don't want that same liability to carry over into our personal lives. So we own it in an LLC. Just make sure that you're dotting all the I's, crossing all the T's in terms of meeting minutes and some of these other things that you need to maintain in order to really look like a business. If it doesn't look like a business, you don't get that corporate kind of shield protection. So just make sure you're doing those things. And if you don't know what I'm referring to, just Google it real quick and you'll find out really pretty simple some of the things that have to be done. But if you don't do those, then you lose that kind of shield.
Okay. Good advice, Rod. Okay. Last thing we want to finish up on, our sixth and final principle within the Invest with Benefits framework or philosophy, that is estate maximization. And on a personal level, this is something that I did a lot of, at least I did. I say it, all of these are ongoing, right? Like yeah. none of them are yeah. one and done. So like my estate maximization, like there is an element from an estate, like estate maximization, part of it might be the way that we have our wills and trusts set up, right? Yep. But part of it is going to be the way that we hold our investments, like actually the way that we're doing investing, right? All of those things together, because guess what? The laws, estate tax laws are different depending on if it's an IRA, a 401k, a piece of real estate, a brokerage account. Like regardless of what my investment is or what money that is, there are some rules that go mm-hmm. along with estate planning. And so the focus here is we have to be looking for opportunities to make sure, well, I shouldn't say we have to, I want to be looking for opportunities yeah. to make sure that my money goes to my family and not to the IRS, at least to the extent that's possible. That's what estate maximization is. It's not necessarily like getting every single dollar. Like it's really about just trying to make sure that the money that you've built, your wealth, is going where you want it.
Yeah.
And that it's doing it in the most seamless way possible. So it takes a few things, right? We have to do some planning. We have to make sure that we have the right structures in place. We definitely need a good estate planning attorney that can help guide us in this stuff, all while we're investing within that kind of framework and philosophy to make it all mesh together. So anyway, for me, this is just, again, a constant ongoing thing. But can I just tell you, I feel really good about the fact that just last year, it's been about a year ago, we got all of our like wills and trusts in place so that if I croak it tomorrow, Rod knows what to do with the business. Heather knows how to like where to get her money. Like that feels really good. Obviously, we don't like to think about dying.
Sure.
But if that is going to happen, it sure feels a lot better to know that I have at least these things in place so that, you know, the money that we've worked so hard to build actually will go to the people that we care about the most.
And by Christian having done that, everybody know that it is critically important to him because it's somewhat of a painful process.
There's a lot of meetings you have to gather.
Yeah, a lot there of is. Just details.
It was painful
in there, but you did it.
It feels good. Nice, it feels good.
Yeah.
And so, you've already done that. You did that years ago with, oh my gosh, I can't think of his name. Tell me his name.
Steve Scablin.
Yes. Yep, Steve, our old friend Steve. Local attorney here. Okay.
So the only thing I'll add to that is life insurance, right? So we obviously do a lot with life insurance. You mentioned earlier the investment optimizer checks all the boxes. Well, that's where, even though we're primarily focused on using it to enhance our investments, the fact that it brings life insurance with it is huge. And so we often talk about this where, in addition to the directing of assets like you just talked about that your will and trust will do, sometimes there are assets that transfer to someone and it's an illiquid asset. The business is an example. Real estate is an example. A lot of different things, right? So a lot of hard assets that we invest in may or may not have any liquidity that could come with them. And that's where having a cash asset that transfers at the same time is hugely valuable. And so that's probably the biggest thing that I see with life insurance. As time goes on and hopefully as my net worth grows, I'll get to a place where I'll be more concerned about going over the estate tax exemption limit. And then I'll rearrange things to make sure my life insurance lands outside of my estate, whereas currently it'll all land in my estate first before that gets calculated. But again, that's the beauty of where we sit, where we get to see people and they get to that place and they're like, okay, I need to do this. And again, like we talked about earlier, it's not an easy process. It's not, there are pros and cons, of course, but when you get to that place, don't be shy about it. Don't hesitate to take steps to create irrevocable trusts, moving assets outside of your estate so that efficiency that we're talking about here, this estate maximization really happens.
Okay. So I like hitting on life insurance. And the reason I do is because I often say that it's the most effective estate maximization tool that we have from an investment perspective. Now, again, mm-hmm. there's structures and things we can do that will have an incredible impact. But when you talk about just a product, I don't know if I want to call it like an asset.
A vehicle, asset,
whatever we want to call it, that transfers, like it's as effective, more effective. Because here's the thing. You look at real estate. Real estate's ultra effective too, right? We get a step up in basis. But life mm-hmm. insurance is a tax-free death benefit. It's essentially a step up in basis. The difference then when they transfer to the next gen is that, to your point, the the real estate's not liquid, the life. So I could have moved that real estate with extremely favorable tax advantages, but still end up an issue if I don't have the liquidity. So the beauty of life insurance is that I get all of the value of the from the tax standpoint with the additional value of having liquidity. We have now been through all six of our core principles within the Invest with Benefits framework. Do you have a favorite, Rod, or are they just all equal to you?
I wouldn't say they're equal. I think you were right that cash flow is the one that speaks just again, because that was my, I don't know, call it my first love, right? Like the catalyst that kind of pushed me in this direction. But it's really hard to argue with really any of them, but tax optimization, like who doesn't want to?
I know they're big. I'm a leverage guy myself. I like leverage. I believe in it. Like I know. Anyway. Okay. I think this has been fun. Do you have any closing thoughts before we sign out?
No, this has been great.
Okay. Thanks everybody for listening and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights Podcast. To learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in the show, please visit moneyinsights.net. The views and opinions expressed on the Money Insights podcast are not intended to be individual financial, tax, or legal advice. Always consult with the appropriate advisor before making financial decisions. And if you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. This will help others find the show and learn wealth-building strategies for themselves. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.